all of us, if we come together and we unify, which is the underlying message of what we've been talking about, then those strengths and those weaknesses will be balanced out, and we'll be able to do so much more because our voices will be that much louder.
We have 10 seconds, Tarana Burke, from dropping the ball at New Year's Eve in New York to the Golden Globes. Your final comment, and then we're going to go into a part two discussion and post it online.
Yeah, I agree with Shailene. I think that this was an amazing moment for us, and I think it symbolizes what's to come.
We have to leave it there. I'll be speaking in Basalt, Colorado tonight at the Temporary. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. The time now is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is Positively Revolting.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Hi, I'm Shaheed Hamid, KBOO board member. As we embark upon a new year, the World Arts Foundation and KBOO wants to continue to honor the life and legacy of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On Monday, January the 15th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., the World Arts Foundation presents its 33rd consecutive tribute to this great American hero and advocate for peace, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 15th, at the Highland Christian Center, speakers, African drumming, and a variety of musical performances, also broadcast live here on KBOO Radio. A tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Where do we go from here? As people, as family, as community. Monday, January 15th at 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Highland Christian Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason. Keep alive the dream.
Happy birthday!
Join KBOO Community Radio on Saturday, January 20th at the Oregon Historical Society as we celebrate our 50th anniversary with the exhibit 50 Years of KBOO.
The microphones were hanging from the heating pipes, and so I said, "Yes, I'm ready to do a program." I was aiming for classical music. He said, "Yeah, but one thing," he said, "I don't want any of this so-called popularity stuff." He said, "I want music that is not heard on other stations." I said, "Oh no, I can do that. There's no problem." So he said, "Yeah, you're on Sunday afternoon."
That's 50 Years of KBOO, Saturday, January 20th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
What would you have instead?
No, this is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world you cast your vote.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and I'm guest hosting for Positively Revolting Talk Radio. And so the first thing that I'd like to do is give a shout out to Ani, who has a nasty cold this morning, and to Lynn, who is also recovering from her illness. And to David K. Johnston, who I'm hoping to get on the phone soon. So at this point, basically, you're listening to improvisation. And when it's time to improvise, it's time to call in the audience. But first, let me tell you what our intended topic is or was this morning. And well, it was Trump. And David K. Johnston has written a book, another book, a second book about Donald Trump. The first one that he wrote was called The Making of Donald Trump. And David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. He actually won the Pulitzer Prize for his beat reporting. And he is also a self-taught lecturer of such quality that he is invited to major universities, even though he doesn't have a university degree. So he's quite the intellectual, and we were looking forward to having him on the air, and we may get him yet to talk about his new book, which is called, as you might expect in framing Donald Trump, it's called It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. And that should prove to be a fascinating interview. But in the meantime, we are here with the headlines and with you. And so let me give you the number to call in. The number to call is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Of course, there's a big word, a big little word, that Donald Trump uttered yesterday, and it's being rendered as S-hole. And it's really interesting to me. Donald Trump referred to Africans generally as coming from S-hole countries. And I'm sure I don't need to explain that the S is for an expletive referring to excrement. And this raises some interesting things. I mean, everyone's getting rather tired of seeing just how far we will have to go to the nadir of Trump's behavior. And the possibility of that nadir, of course, is thermonuclear war. And so this is a terrifying thing, really, even though I take a lighthearted tone towards it. I've noticed already, listening on to my shock, I guess that shows that I'm getting old, I heard the S word on NPR. And it seems to me that since the president has uttered this word, NPR has suddenly decided that they can utter this word. And this is previously one of the seven deadly words. I'll tell you right now, if you call in, we're not going to allow it onto the air because I'm not going to take that chance. I'm going to assume that NPR simply has more clout with the FCC than I or KBOO could possibly have. So we're not going to say the S word here on the air, but it was interesting to me that the S word is now receiving this currency, and it's also a little disgusting to me, not because of the word itself. I don't care. I mean, it's just it's simply a reference to human and animal function. If you were in the Netherlands or Germany or whatever, they use those words, not the English words, of course. And no one cares because they're not so prudish in that regard. They don't have that American peculiarity going on. And I never thought that we really should either. But nonetheless, as I said, I've gone my whole life carefully avoiding saying that and several other words on the air. And here now I hear it just because, well, frankly, that idiot, the fool on the hill, as the Beatles would have it, has uttered that word. So this is just emblematic of the degradation of the nature of conversation we've had on just about everything since the 62 million fools elected Donald Trump. And that tells you about my left opinion, which I will just let hang out here. Because how much left opinion do you actually hear when you're listening to broadcast radio? Well, I have some great news. It would appear that we have David K. Johnston on the air. And David, as I was saying, is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, author, and expert on taxes, accounting, economic, public finance, and business ancient societies. He is a distinguished visiting lecturer who teaches tax, property, and regulatory law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law and Whitman School of Management. And really glad to have David on the air. David K. Johnston, welcome to the KBOO airwaves once again.
Well, thank you for having me again.
I know that you were expecting to hear Ani Haynes' voice this morning, and she is actually sick, and so I came in at the last minute and tried to grab some notes from her. So now you know the shaky ground on which we are standing. But I really want to talk to you about your writings and about your latest book, and especially since we are once again in the swirl of controversy from the actions of the current American president. Tell me, what was it that got your attention with Donald Trump years ago when you first wrote a book about him?
Well, when I first met Donald in 1988, I had left the L.A. Times, where I had exposed what everybody now knows about the LAPD, that this was the first work done on that, and went to cover the casino industry in Atlantic City for the Philadelphia Inquirer because I believed that we were going to see casino gambling explode all across America, which it did. And I met Donald Trump almost immediately upon arriving in town and immediately sized him up as our era's P.T. Barnum. Come and see the amazing two-headed woman in the Fiji Mermaid, and realized pretty quickly that he was a con artist. He didn't know anything about the casino business, something when I was told that initially by his competitors, by government officials, and his own executives, I found hard to believe, but after interviewing him, I realized it's all a con job. He doesn't know anything about the casino business, just as we all know today, he doesn't know anything about tax policy, nuclear weapons, diplomacy. The list is endless. But I also decided he was important, that his salesmanship said that he was going to be significant to America's cultural life. And so I started tracking him, and I now have what I'm pretty confident is the world's largest collection of Trump documents. It's tens of thousands of pages. So I wrote a book about the casino industry in 1992 called Temples of Chance. There's a lot about Donald in that book and how the how he was a terrible businessman. The only known case of a casino cheating customers was at Trump's castle in Atlantic City.
The only known case of a casino cheating customers, that's something.
That's right. And partly because you make more money with an honest game, as old man Binion, who started Binion's Horseshoe in downtown Las Vegas, used to say. Then in 2015, when Donald made his latest announcement of running for president, something he'd been talking about since 1985, I immediately was alarmed. I was concerned that he just might get in, and certainly that he could get the Republican nomination, and tried to alert my fellow journalists. I wrote about two dozen columns and articles, many of which were aimed at journalists, and saying, here are questions you should ask, here's the public record, and nobody did. Everybody was so fascinated with what a bizarre campaign he was running that nobody said, well, what about your involvement with Russian mobsters? What about your swindling of investors? What about the workers you cheated? What about the findings that you discriminated in employment against blacks, women, and Asians? And most importantly, what about the favors you did in your years of deep involvement with a major international cocaine trafficker? So then I wrote a book in a big hurry in 2016 called The Making of Donald Trump, which is the number one selling book in the world about him, or at least maybe it'll be surpassed by Fire and Fury, but not yet. And it's in 11 languages. And then when he won the Electoral College after losing the popular vote, I did two things. I started a nonprofit free news service, no ads, called DCReport.org. D.C. being a play on David Kaye and Washington, D.C., dcreport.org. And I set out to write a book about what Trump is doing to America and the rest of the world. And my new book comes out Tuesday. It's Even Worse Than You Think. Documents stuff that has gotten little or no attention in the news about how he is putting your health, your employment, your safety at risk, not because he's out there working hard, because he spends less than 5 hours a day being president, but the people he's put into the government, and that Steve Bannon and Steve Miller and Goldman Sachs people he brought in have put into the government are systematically destroying those aspects of the federal government to protect your health, your safety, and your income.
It seems that you are describing a man who is very good at and very practiced at demagoguery, and that seems to be his main skill, and then he brings in whoever he needs to keep his power base going, and he seems to be ruling from that base. He seems to be comfortable.
Well, presidents in America do not rule. They administer. Let's be very clear. We don't have kings. We are not going to, as Omarosa Omergold said, we're all going to bend our knee to him. Donald would like to be a dictator. He would like to be king with absolute power. He thinks he should have absolute power. He believes he is superior to the rest of us, and that, of course, he should be president. But he is an administrator. He is our employee whose duty is to faithfully execute the laws passed by Congress. Unfortunately, Donald thinks he's in charge, and we're supposed to do what he wants.
All right, then, I won't use the word rule, and I'll say instead that he seems to intend to use a minority, basically an apartheid power base, to project.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Donald has always been a racist. He's been found in formal proceedings to have discriminated in housing, discriminated in employment. He's said things for years, long before his latest comments, that make it clear. And of course, during Charlottesville, he referred to neo-Nazis and other racists as fine people, or at least some of them. Donald wants a white America, and he wants us to not pay attention to the fact that, you know, his grandfather came here as a draft dodger evading the German draft in 1885, lied to get his citizenship, and ran whorehouses, which is how he got rich. He had whorehouses in Seattle, in Everett, Washington, and in the Yukon Territory. He comes from a family of criminals, and he's a criminal and has been his whole life.
And so we see this in his style of governance. And I imagine that this is what your book is generally about. So let me ask you specifically then to start off with, what is he doing to the federal bench? What are his people doing?
Right. Obama was unable to get all sorts of people, especially and most significantly, of course, the Supreme Court appointee, because the racist Republicans led by Mitch McConnell invented a new clause in the Constitution that presidents in their last year can't appoint to the Supreme Court if we don't like them and they're black. He has been appointing, in some cases, utterly unqualified people who have withdrawn. A Republican member of Congress, you know, questioned one of the appointees, and this person didn't even remember basic things you should learn in law school, had never been involved in litigation, had never filed papers in court. Many lawyers, of course, never appear in court, and withdrew. It's not Trump doing this, let's be clear. It is the people I call in my book the political termites who are eating away at the substance of our government. The people that Steve Bannon and Steve Miller and people like that around Trump have put into the federal government, who are appointing people and undertaking policies inimical to the interests of everybody except the clients of Goldman Sachs. And let's not forget, Donald ran for office against Goldman Sachs and then stocked his cabinet and administration with Goldman Sachs people and put out two different outlines of tax plans which read like shopping lists for Goldman Sachs.
And seems to be just unruffled by criticism of his straight-up contradictions.
Well, I'm sorry. You think Donald isn't perfect and never needs to apologize? What's wrong with you? Seriously, what's wrong with you? That's Donald's attitude about it. I mean, having jousted with Donald for 30 years, if Donald creates his own reality, if he says something, you're supposed to accept that that's true. And if you don't, well, there's something wrong with you. And if you point out that he said the exact opposite a half an hour ago, no, I didn't. You realize Trump has now come around to saying that it's not his voice on the Billy Bush tape where he brags about committing sexual assault. And it's absurd, but you know that's his latest claim.
Well, you know, and if I'm sorry to interrupt, but it seems to me that he actually has a resonance there. It's like his followers are so deeply into channeling their thoughts and their analyses through loyalty that he really can, as he says, go out into Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and get away with it with them.
Well, absolutely right. And two things about this. Donald's economic platform was the platform I've previously been on KBOO about that was laid out in my books, Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print, which are all still in print years later. The first book came out in 2003, and it's still in print and still used to teach tax policy. He took my economic platform, which is the elites in Washington are buying votes and getting rules that take money out of your pocket in subtle ways you wouldn't be aware of except for reading my books and enriching themselves at your expense. And then he added a bit of an evil twist to it. But his platform comes basically right out of my books. And the bottom 90% of Americans have legitimate grievances. Their incomes haven't grown. They are in debt. Their jobs are insecure. Their pensions are non-existent or stolen. Their healthcare system is getting worse and more expensive. And they have real grievances that Donald brilliantly exploited. He is, as a con artist, he is the most successful con artist the world has ever seen. He conned the United States of America into putting him in the most powerful job in the world, a job for which he is manifestly unfit.
Well, I can only agree. I mean, this is a grievous situation. We have so many people who simply cannot make sufficient wages to make rent. I mean, it comes down to that. And along comes a con man to make things that much worse. Just before you came on, I was inviting calls. And so I want to check with you what sort of interview would you like to have?
Let's
want to take calls?
What people want to ask about.
Okay.
Okay,
let me see if we still have someone waiting. Okay, yes, Sean is on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson. I enjoy your work, and I also enjoy a Trump bashing session just as much as the next guy. One example of that would be Bret Easton Ellis's ugly little novel, American Psycho, features a serial killer who constantly refers to Donald Trump as his hero. I'm kind of surprised I haven't heard about that more often, but the reason I'm calling this morning is that on the one hand, yes, of course, we bash Trump, but on the other hand, I call KBOO quite a bit, and I constantly refer to this contradiction, and that as people's lives become more desperate and degraded and painful, unfortunately, they seem to be turning more towards this fetishization of the business culture. These personal finance authors have exploded, like Dave Ramsey, Clark Howard, Susie Orman, and so on and so on and so on. And there's this kind of market populist idea that business culture is for the little guy, that we can all be entrepreneurs. And while we bash Trump, of course we bash Trump, the larger problem that I see is this kind of culture of business worship and entrepreneurial worship. And I was wondering if you'd address that contradiction for me. Thanks.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, let's never forget that only 1 in 100 people can be in the top 1%. Doesn't matter how you slice it, you know, when I interview taxi drivers who think they're going to be millionaires, it's like, really? You know, maybe one of you somewhere. But secondly, we have created, since we left the age of FDR, which was with the election of Reagan, a society where we judge people not by the content of their character, as Martin Luther King proposed, but by the content, or in the case of Donald Trump, the claimed content of their wallet. And there's no relationship between economic well-being and whether you're a good person or a bad person. But we seem to confuse that. The reason I think people like Dave Ramsey, who actually does a pretty good job of giving people advice, do well, is that people are in such bad economic straits. And I document every year in detail and analyze the wage data, and economists and other people rely on my analysis because then they don't have to do it themselves. And the income data. And people are having real serious struggles. And here's probably the most significant number to keep in mind. George Bush said his tax policy was going to make us all better off. So I tracked it for the 12 years his tax cuts were in full effect. And during that period of time, Americans had as income $6.3 trillion less money than if we had stayed at the year 2000, which is the year he said he was going to make us better off from. I didn't pick the year he did. That's enough money, if it was divided evenly among all Americans, to have paid all the income taxes, all the Social Security and Medicare taxes on it, to have paid off every car loan, every credit card debt, every student loan in America, and every family in America, after all of that, would have $20,000 cash. His tax cuts were devastating. But, you know, I meet people, and I have people call in when I do right-wing radio all the time about how we're all better off because of George Bush, and we're not. That's not what the data show. So when people lose control of their economic lives, they often turn to demagogues. That's what Carl Polanyi wrote about after World War II. How did the fascists come to power? People lost control of their economic lives, and they turned to whoever sold the best story of I'll make you better off.
Interesting. Well, thank you for that then. And the next caller is Ted. Are you there, Ted? You're on the
yes,
air.
Yes, I am. Hello, Mr. Johnson. It's good to talk to you. Say, I would like to insert somehow or another here that with all the stuff going on around Mr. Mueller and all the Russian investigations, why shouldn't somebody just assume that there are Russian spies in the White House?
Well, I don't know that I would say Russian spies, but I mean, I think Donald Trump has divided loyalties at a minimum, and he may well end up being established to be a Russian agent. We know that Donald has been dependent on Russian money since 1983, that he has done deals that I've described in my books that make no economic sense, but would make perfect sense if you believe that the Russians have been investing in Trump the way venture capitalists do. You know, venture capitalists will approve 100 projects. 95 of them will lose every dollar. Four of them will make back the money lost on the 95. And one of them will turn out to be a grand slam home run. In economic terms, that would be backing Google or Amazon. In political terms, if you got your guy in the White House, and more important to the Russians, you made sure the person who was going to try and force you to give up Crimea and, if not, pay enormous pain, did not get into the White House. And so Donald Trump clearly has divided loyalties. At an absolute minimum, he has divided loyalties. Whether, how far it goes, we don't know. And one thing to be clear about, by the way, in these debates, no one in the Trump campaign can have committed treason. Under our Constitution, treason can only occur when we are at war. And Congress has not declared war since 1941, and we have, as a matter of law, not been at war since 1945. So even if Donald Trump is an absolute tool of Vladimir Putin, that's not treason. It's a violation of his oath of office, and it's undoubtedly things that he could be imprisoned for if convicted, but it can't technically be treason. It can only politically be treason.
David Johnston, can you talk about money laundering in Soho Tower?
Sure. Just to be clear, I always use the middle name because there's another investigative reporter, so it's always David K. Johnston, or in our case, David is mine.
My apology.
Soho Tower was a project built with Russian mobsters. Trump had an 18% profit participation in it. The banks lost money. The people who bought apartments lost money. Donald got paid an unknown amount of money. And the profits from that building, thanks to a letter Donald Trump signed authorizing this, all disappeared, because there were profits to the people behind it, the mob guys, into an Icelandic bank, which was, as the other two Icelandic banks were, under the control of a Russian oligarch. We don't know what happened to that money. To make sure the public never sees the records of the transactions that took place, and there's a good reason to think that this was a $250 million tax fraud that enriched making this stuff public.
And would you say that is going, that follow the money sort of revelation is going to be the primary outcome of all these investigations, of the Mueller and the congressional investigations?
Yes. And look at the team Mueller has put together. There are people, prosecutors, who had left and gone into private practice and were making $1 million and multimillion-dollar incomes, who came back for $190,000 a year. Nothing compared to what they're being paid, because this is the most important thing they will ever do in their lives. Donald Trump has been, clearly we're going to find that Donald Trump has been involved in laundering money for Russians and other inappropriate activity, just as, although I don't expect Mueller to go into it, he was deeply involved with this international cocaine trafficker, Joe Wechselbaum, that I've written about repeatedly. And the financial dealings that Trump has done that we know about. Many of them make no economic sense, but if you look upon them as the Russian government, the Kremlin, investing in Trump in order to get someone friendly to them in the White House or in business in America, those things then make perfect sense.
Well, now I really am fascinated and want to ask you about the cocaine, but Leah has been waiting patiently on the line, so we'll go to Leah next. Hello, you're on KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson. I'm very aware of your work. I have not read your latest books, but I have been watching some old films on Netflix that are very prominent right now on the Seymour Child, not just the Nazis, but the Japanese. But I've watched a number of the films on the Nazis, and what I'm, and they show the vintage of how they got there and the fanfare. And what I'm seeing is a whole bunch of parallels between what they did and what's occurring in culture right now, and what the people bought, the hook, line, and sinker, didn't pay attention to. And not only are those people the judges and the leadership of the Nazi Party on trial, but the culture should have been on trial too, and we should be on trial. We, our culture,
what
we're doing to our
nation
is criminal. So I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not sure I detected a question there, but you know, part of the reason Trump is in office is not enough people understood that he's been a criminal his entire life. And like most successful criminals, of course, he's never been arrested. He beat 4 grand juries. He had 2 civil, not criminal, but civil trials for tax fraud. He lost both of them. He's confessed to being a sales tax cheat. He's been found to have engaged in a conspiracy to cheat his illegal immigrant employees out of their wages. And the list just goes on and on and on. But unfortunately, during the campaign, the major news organizations, including the big papers I work for, the New York Times and the LA Times, failed to do what we call scrub the candidate.
Failed to scrub the candidate?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you're supposed to do when somebody's running for president is you go back and run down their life. So you can read news accounts that will tell you, for example, who Barack Obama's pals were in kindergarten in Indonesia and the boys he hung out with in high school in Hawaii and even women he dated when he was a college student. You won't find any coverage like that about Donald Trump. During the camp, from the day Donald Trump announced in June of 2015 until the election 16 months later, Trump and Mafia appeared only 4 times in the New York Times, 2 in the opinion section, and they were all passing references. Was there any serious examination of Donald Trump's deep involvement with lots of criminals? No. Was there even a mention of his involvement with Joe Wechselbaum, the confessed international drug trafficker whose case ended up before Donald Trump's sister in a state where no crime was alleged to have occurred, and who got incredibly lenient treatment? He spent 18 months in prison. The people who drove the drugs got 20 years. No, none of that made any of the big mainstream news organizations, and I think it's because they were so fascinated by his unconventional campaign tactics, they forgot the basics.
So what is Trump's connection then to Wechselbaum? Is it through his sister?
When Donald Trump got his casino license, without being properly and thoroughly vetted, and despite the fact that he had beaten 4 grand jury investigations and he tried to hide 2 of them, which should have disqualified him, he needed helicopters to fly high rollers into Atlantic City from New York, Connecticut, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington. There are a lot of helicopter companies. Instead of using one of the reasonably well-established companies the other casinos did, he went to a lightly financed new company run by a twice convicted felon and mob associate named Joseph Wechselbaum. His company went bankrupt and went bankrupt again. It was mostly financed by the taxpayers of New Jersey rather than private capital. And then Wechselbaum was indicted in October of 1985 for running a major international drug trafficking ring. We brought in cocaine and marijuana from Colombia and sent it to Cincinnati. And Wechselbaum confessed. He admitted that he personally handled the drugs. Now, that's a very important element here. The chairman of ExxonMobil does not pump gasoline, and Joe Bonanno, the head of the Bonanno crime family, you know, in his autobiography said that the newspapers say that I deal in heroin. I've never even seen heroin. Well, of course he hasn't seen heroin. Joe Wechselbaum admitted that he personally handled the drugs. His case was transferred from Cincinnati, Ohio, and neither the defense lawyer or the prosecutor could ever explain this, to the New Jersey courtroom of a newly appointed federal judge, Marianne Trump Berry, Donald's older sister. She had flown in the helicopters of this guy, and there's good reason to think he actually personally piloted some of those flights. Her husband flew in the helicopters every week because he was a lawyer for Trump's casinos. She removed herself from the case, but it was assigned to her closest friend on the bench, and he got incredibly light treatment. And this is this massive drug operation, tons of drugs, and cocaine shipments in 100 kilo amounts. And he served 18 months, but the people who drove the drugs from Miami up to Ohio, they got up to 20 years. And Donald wrote a letter pleading for mercy for Wechselbaum. As a casino owner, he should have lost his license for this stuff. Instead, the New Jersey casino regulators very carefully never asked the questions that would have forced them to kick him out of the business. And the key question they never asked is, why did you do these favors for this drug trafficker? Were you in business with him? Were you financing his business? Were you profiting from the drug trafficking? They never asked those questions.
Fascinating. You are listening to Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm your guest host, Teresa Mitchell, on KBOO Portland, and I have David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Award-winning journalism, and in context of what he was just saying, I would like to point out that Pulitzer was for beat reporting, so this sort of detail is very much in his genre. And I am taking calls. The number to call, 503-231-8187, and Cody is on the air.
Good morning, Teresa. Good morning, Johnston. I sort of kind of have a two-part question, because the due diligence on the details of the investigation of Trump past doing, which I can 100% agree, I was rather shocked that he made it past the Republican runoff. But you're talking about a lot of things insofar as illegal drug running into the United States, as well as other nefarious means. And my question is, was he the only person doing it? And why don't we put this level of due diligence on the whole system and not just him? And is it possible he feels as confident as he does, because he knows where all the bodies are buried on both sides?
I haven't seen any evidence that any other presidential candidate has been involved in the drug trafficking. Okay.
Okay, and this is including the Iran-Contra affair that went down.
I was about to go to that exact point. The only case we have is this political decision that was made to finance the Contras through this drug scheme back in the 1980s. But Ronald Reagan wasn't personally involved in drug trafficking. He wasn't doing it as a business. He wasn't palling around.
I didn't think Ronald Reagan was, but I heard that there's some people in his cabinet that eventually became president that had something to do with it, and a lot of it was connected
to
CIA.
Nobody in his cabinet went on to become president.
George
but
Bush?
That was a political decision, which I think was an awful, terrible decision, and we rightly judge that you shouldn't have done this, and it violated everything that you said you stood for. But there's no suggestion anywhere that Reagan was personally corrupt.
No, I don't. I'm not saying that Reagan or implying that Reagan had anything to do with it. What I am saying is that the level of due diligence on this present president is great, but I wish we had this level of due diligence with the entire system, because the American people would have been able to make a good choice in the first place. One, and I mean, two, all this was right around between the 80s and like after the mid 90s was like right when the wall fell down and Russia went in collapse. And what's the connection between the collapse of Russia and what happened with certain investors trying to basically chop Russia up and sell it off to the highest bidder? Or is that just
That I can explain to you very easily. And there's a lot in both my books, The Making of Donald Trump, that's already out. In my book that comes out Tuesday, It's Even Worse Than You Think, and that DC report about this. But essentially, when the Soviet Union collapsed, criminals took over the Soviet government, the new Russian government. The wealth of the Soviet people was stolen. They had a desperate need to move money, hide money, raise money in some cases. And so through Deutsche Bank, the only bank with large direct loans to Donald Trump, through the Bank of Cyprus, whose vice chairman was Wilbur Ross, Donald Trump's commerce secretary, and other means, and including the Icelandic banks, this criminal gang that operates under Vladimir Putin has been trying to undermine Western societies to steal money. The whole Icelandic bank scam, for example, was really a raid on Dutch and British retirement plans, pension plans, by getting them to put money into these Icelandic banks, which were under the control of one of the Russian oligarchs. And this, the Donald Trump goes around, you know, speaking well of the Kremlin is astonishing. I would encourage you to go to the New York Times website and look up the email that was written to Donald Trump Jr. that the Trumps have lied about at least six different ways. And notice the opening language. The Crown Prosecutor, that's the Attorney General of Russia, the Crown Prosecutor, as part of our efforts to help your campaign. What that language tells you is the Russians were already helping the Trumps, and the Trumps knew it. Because if this was brand new, you would write a very tentative note saying, we'd like to find out if you'd be interested in learning about stuff, or would it be possible to arrange a meeting where we might discuss the possibility of helping you. This thing assumes there's ongoing help, and this is just a new development in it. That's one of the most undercovered stories in the country, and like many important stories, it's right in front of our eyes as journalists, but you have to pay attention and come to your own analysis of it, not rely on what other people say about the guy.
And it's that context that is given credence to the idea in the Steele dossier that the Russians have compromise on Trump. Well, your new book, It's Worse Than You Think, also apparently goes into what Trump is doing to the government, and it's and could you expand on that a bit? We talked bit about what he's doing his first year.
It's even worse than you think. What I do in that is what you haven't read or seen on TV. Trump personally isn't doing this, but the people Trump brought in have put these political termites into the government. They are fulfilling Steve Bannon's program to destroy the government. Bannon was quite explicit. He wants to destroy the federal government. He called himself a Leninist, and he said that he wants to get rid of the administrative structures of the state. So I cite and show how, for example, Trump says, every decision I make will be on behalf of American workers. Well, there's a very small government program to help small manufacturers with exports. Its return to the taxpayers is on the order of $800 for each dollar the taxpayers spend. And I don't like subsidies, but, you know, 800-to-1 return, anybody with a brain would say, let's keep that. They're working to get rid of it. They put your life in danger through killing a new rule that the Obama administration had in process. We've had these terrific train and truck and bus accidents where we find out that the driver or conductor fell asleep because they had a malady called sleep apnea, where you just fall asleep. I mean, I have sleep apnea, and it's 100% treatable. Well, we require it of airline pilots, thank God. But the Trump administration, in the guise of there's too much regulation, has said we're not going to test truck drivers, train conductors, and bus drivers for sleep apnea. That means they're putting you in danger. And people will die because of this. They have decided to allow coal-burning power plants to continue using 1910 technology to get rid of coal ash. After you burn the carbon, you have this toxic residue that's full of heavy metals like mercury and cadmium. And historically, power plants would just spray it all with water, turn it into a slurry, have it flow downhill to an artificial pond, usually beside a river. And we've had several of these slurry dikes break in recent years, ruining the water for months in rivers, killing all the fish and making the water undrinkable. And instead of stopping this problem, which we can get rid of, we can require drying out this material and not putting it next to rivers, the Trump administration is encouraging they do more of this. And my book is full of these examples of where your income, your savings, your health, and your safety are all being put at risk by this administration, and it's the story you haven't heard. And I'm hoping people read this, because I just talked to somebody today, this morning, who got an advanced copy of the book, who called me and said, I didn't know about all this stuff. Holy mackerel, this is vastly worse than anything I've heard. And I went, yeah, the trick is I've got to get millions of people to read this or it won't matter. We'll just keep doing what we're doing. People have to realize it isn't just the outrageous things Donald says, the racist things he says. He is literally undermining our country. He is damaging our country and our environment in ways that you're not seeing, because it's not, you know, news media in Washington basically covers controversy. They don't cover issues. I write about policy, not politics.
All right. And I believe Ellie is on the line. Oh, excuse me. Sean is next.
Good morning.
Hi, Sean.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson. Thanks for being on. Teresa, thanks for the show. I'll tell you, I just feel incredibly frustrated at a lot of this for different reasons. But there's a lot covered here. I'll just try to make it short, take my answer off the air. You know, Chris Hedges just came out recently, or I should say David Talbot interviewed Chris Hedges for a book that came out last year. You know, and you know Chris Hedges had the falling out with the New York Times, and he's basically does what he can to get out there to talk about all of this kind of thing going on, and he starves just by teaching classes at a community college because he's so outspoken. And as much as I appreciate what you're saying, it's very frustrating to hear that so much emphasis is always putting on the face of Donald Trump. But Cody was right, is that he acts so incredibly narcissistic and arrogant, not only because that's who he is, but he knows how he's protected. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you take into account the book Democracy in Chains, which just came out by Nancy McLean, which is an incredible book, and you incorporate Jane Meyer's book on dark money, or you take in The Shadow World about the global arms trade by Andrew Feinstein that came out in 2010, you know, this thing is so much deeper and has been going along that, you know, Trump is just the current face of a much deeper shadow world of politics that really runs and controls this thing. So, I'd really like to know,
Sean,
your insight.
Yeah, so Sean, let me respond to that. One of the points I make in It's Even Worse Than You Think is Donald Trump is not the disease. Donald Trump is the symptom of the disease.
Right.
After Watergate, and I had a small piece of the Watergate story back then, we passed all these campaign finance reform laws to clean up money in politics. Well, that's backfired. It's made it vastly worse, and it's greatly enhanced the power of people like the Koch brothers, who, you know, understand the Koch brothers are not corrupt. The Koch brothers believe the stuff they're doing, and if you'd had their father and grown up in their household, there's a high likelihood you would have grown up with the same set of
values. I wouldn't agree with that, because the Koch brothers have a long history of being very corrupt, and as David Koch said, I want my share and he's proven it in how he's treated even the Navajo Nation in stealing the right.
Sean, let me be clear what I mean about corrupt.
Huh?
they walk their talk. They believe what they're doing.
Well, you
okay?
can say
I think they're wrong.
They're doing
I think
in
their
own way, but to say
wrong.
Give them a pass and say they're not corrupt is just
I'm
wrong.
I'm not giving them a pass. I'm not giving them a pass. But my point is that they sincerely believe the things that they're doing. They are not intellectually corrupt, okay? They're not saying one thing and doing another. They're consistent in their behavior. And by the way, as managers of their businesses, they're pretty good stewards. Their policies are awful. They're despicable. But they are stuff they sincerely believe, and they believe the rest of us would be better off if we saw the world the way they do. They're wrong, and the way you defeat them is to show that they're wrong and that there are better ideas and that they have terrible ideas. Now, the Donald Trump is simply the symptom of a deeper problem. Americans have not been paying attention to and doing the work of being citizens. That's the real underlying problem. Why do we have a Congress like we do that is thoroughly and completely in the thrall of the wealthiest people in America? That's what I wrote my trilogy of books about, Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and the Fine Print, because so many Americans have not been paying attention to politics. The institutions that support their involvement, unions and social justice movements, have shriveled away to nothing. You know, there was a time when the interfaith movement in Washington, New York City, had an entire building full of different religious organizations promoting social justice. They're now reduced to one little rented office. So the underlying problem is with us. Donald Trump is our employee, and he shouldn't be in office, but he is, and we've got to live with that for the time being. But we need to recognize that if you didn't turn out to vote, if you didn't educate people around you about the issues, we're the underlying problem in all of this, and we have to fix it. Part of being a democratic republic is we choose our destiny, and our country horribly and unfortunately has chosen to put a narcissistic con artist criminal in the White House who is utterly incompetent. But he didn't get there through seizing power. He's not a dictator, even though he thinks he is. He got there because he won enough votes in enough states to win the Electoral College.
It's sad, isn't it, to think that the American electorate, or at least 62 million, are have so devolved in their education and their societal awareness to elect a demagogue like that, particularly after he was so clear about being a racist.
The reason I think he was successful in doing that is two elements. One is the awful economic plight of the bottom 90% of Americans that I've written just extensively about for 25 years. It's been the real focus of my work for 25 years, is documenting how government policies are making the 90% worse off and the top 10th of 1% so fabulously well off. And the second element in this, and it is an important element, is there is a significant minority of Americans who hate the civil rights movement. You know, they don't want to have a Latino sitting next to them on the airplane, an Asian pilot, or God forbid, a black woman boss. They can't say that unless they have incredibly low-level jobs, because society will run you off for that and it'll ruin your career. But that doesn't mean they don't harbor those feelings. There are plenty of educated, well-to-do people I know who come up to me and said, well, you know, Trump's really right. And I go, right about what? Well, you know, like, you know, the niggers. And I go, what? And this is endemic in our society. Remember, we live in a society where Fox News, which did very high-quality polling for years, found year after year that about 44% of Americans think an angel is following them around, about 27-28% believe there are witches, and about 24-3% believe there are warlocks. And, of course, if you believe in witches but not warlocks, that's a pretty good indicator you're a sexist. But there are a lot of people who hate the civil rights movement. We're making progress. Look how fast gay marriage went from being beyond the pale to being widely accepted. But we still have a long way to go, and there are a lot of people who, when they hear Donald Trump use a vulgar term to describe Haiti and Africa, they may not say so publicly, but privately they cheer.
The author of the book is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Award-winning journalist, lecturer, historian, and the new book is called It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. You're listening to Positively Revolting I'm guest host Teresa Mitchell, and Elliot has been waiting to talk. Are you still there, Elliot?
Yes. Well, my question, which sort of matches nicely onto the last part of what you just said, is whether you'd consider, either as a solo work or as an edited book like you did with Inequality, to take up a project on trying to diagnose and treat what I'll call the progressive decline of progressive institutions since at least the late 70s. Because I heard you on KPFA, because I'm a long-term fan, I heard you complain that you almost lost your presentation time because of how disorganized a conference was and that the left doesn't have its act together. And I think we need to address this systematically, because things are really moribund and incompetent all the way on the spectrum, from the Democratic Party itself all the way down to things like KBOO. All of Pacifica is about to go bankrupt because they defaulted on $2 million of judgment against the Empire State Building out of like $8 million of total debt.
Okay, Elliot, and I'm going to address that myself, since you're going to attack KBOO directly. What you're saying is simply not correct. In the first place, the latest news on the Pacifica Foundation is that they have floated a $2 million loan, and they are moving forward to resolve the debt that has resulted from an excessive and aggressive attempt to collect for their transmitter on the Empire State Building. That's turning around. Secondly, KBOO, the KBOO Foundation, is in good shape. It's quite competent. We are moving forward. This is our 50th anniversary year. We are financially solvent. We certainly need your contributions on a continuing basis, and we need to build that up. But we're doing a good job here, and this is a solid radio station, and will continue to be so in the future.
So, Teresa, let me address Elliot's other point.
Okay.
Outside of the internecine issues about public radio, and particularly Pacifica. One of the issues that I've raised is that I speak to all sorts of groups, right-wing, left-wing, CEO groups, union groups, and one of the things I'm struck by is that many of the progressive and liberal organizations that bring me in are not well organized. People at the particular event that he mentioned were supposed to come and have breakfast and then listen to people talk, including me, and there was a line of people, long, long, long line, 200 people, and they didn't have the lanyards laid out, and so they had to go into a box and, you know, dig around for lanyards. I mean, it was just bizarre to see how disorganized this was, and they didn't take it well when I suggested they be more businesslike. This is a real problem with progressives. When I go to speak to conservative groups, they are organized, they are on time, they do business. Progressive groups, generally, they're not well-disciplined, they don't follow good practices, and so I have repeatedly tried to encourage people to say, you've got to pay attention to your knitting. The reason the minority party is in control of Congress is they paid attention to how the voter laws are written and trying to block people from voting and getting the vote out on Election Day. And bitching and moaning and griping and writing things on the Internet isn't going to get the job done. You've got to do the work, and you've got to do it in an organized, professional fashion.
Well, and I think a good example of a well-organized group here in the Portland area would be 350.org, and they've had quite the international effect with their protests, most notably the kayaktivists who brought attention to drilling through the Arctic ice by blocking a tug here.
And did the big demonstration. And there are lots of groups that are well-organized, and I'm not trying to dump on everybody, but there is a real serious problem here with the quality of organizing by a lot of groups that are progressive and liberal, and people need to pay attention to it.
I actually agree with you on that. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing right, I think is where you're going with that.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit more about your book. Who is publishing your book, and when's it coming out?
It's Even Worse Than You Think is published by Simon & Schuster in English all around the world. It comes out in the U.S., Britain, Australia, et cetera, on Tuesday the 16th. I'll be on
Morning Joe that day and on Chris Hayes that evening and a bunch of other TV shows we've lined up, CNN and elsewhere. That's also being published in German on the same day in Europe. And my previous Trump book, The Making of Donald Trump, eventually we got 11 languages. We may still get a couple more. And I expect this book will be published in some additional languages. And this book is going to explain in a coherent narrative fashion, here is what Trump is doing to you, to your family, to your job, to the country. And he is doing awful damage. So I don't focus on his crazy statements, his racist statements, his tweets. I use some of them here and there where they're useful, but I'm primarily telling you, here's what he's doing to our government. And, you know, let's remember that the reason that we're free is we have a government with rules and a system that's designed to protect us. It's not perfect. We are far, far, far from perfect.
We'll have to leave it at that.
We're better off.
Because we are out of time, and I do think that your book will do very well because of the work that you have done. And because it's, well, it's good timing. I think I can confidently predict it will sell very well. Congratulations on the book, David K. Johnston.
And if some listeners want to organize for me to come out on a trip to speak, I'll be glad to do it.
It's Positively Revolting. Stay tuned to KBOO Portland at 9. Beloved Community speaks with three of the hosts of the upcoming Roots of Conflict Conference. And on 10, Valley Views, part two of the discussion with Richard Heinberg, senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, on his article, Are We Doomed? Let's Talk. 10:15 Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Thanks for tuning in.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio